stretched below him, looking at the names on the flight map of the world, he sees it now. He spins the globe on the screen. Will he ever visit Dar es Salaam? Jeddah. There's Dubai. Looking at Rosie again, Steve wonders now what he must look like asleep. How small he must look, how fragile. Sometimes when Steve wakes, trouble is curled up on his chest. Steve has always thought that trouble was looking for Steve's protection. But what if trouble is protecting him? What if trouble sees the young child Steve still is, that we all still are when we sleep, and understands that he needs protecting? Amy is working on her laptop, her face lit by the glow of the screen, looking at the files that Susan Knox has sent over. How does Amy hide? Steve wonders. Where does she go? Steve touches her arm and Amy looks up. Everything is silent except the cocooning drone of the engines keeping them alive. Are you scared? Steve asks. He has wanted to ask her this many times, but he was frightened of the answer. Amy smiles at him. Yes, are you? Of course, says Steve. I'm always scared. Me too, says Amy. I'm just very good at running away from it. I know, says Steve, or punching it, or shooting it. You know, if you ever wanted, we could talk about you growing up, all of that. I know we could, says Amy. And you know we could talk about how sad you feel. I know we could, says Steve. You found anything else in those files? Nope, says Amy. No Francois Loubet, no Joe Blow. You? Nope, says Steve. He's lying. There is a very interesting name hidden in the files, a name Steve recognises, though he has a lot of work to do before he can say anything. He also has another worry. Seeing as Courtney Lewis, our friend imprisoned in Dubai, was another vivid viral booking, we should probably think a bit more about Felicity Wollaston. Tony Taylor's new girlfriend. Amy arches an eyebrow. She's just being used. Maybe, says Steve. I hope so, for Tony's sake. Adam's seeing Courtney Lewis when he gets to Dubai. She'll have some answers, says Amy. Quick tour of the vineyard, see what we can see, talk to whoever will talk to us, then get ads on Zoom and put our heads together. I'm glad you asked Adam to help, says Steve. He's very good, you know, says Amy. At what? Says Steve. At everything, says Amy. He's an amazing man. That's nice to hear, says Steve. I still see the boy. That's because you're both idiots, and you don't spend any time together, says Amy. Believe it or not, you'd get on. You don't spend much time with him either, says Steve. I worry about that sometimes. We don't need to spend time together for now, says Amy. That doesn't make sense, Amy, says Steve. It would make sense if you understood leveraged future options, says Amy. We have forever. No one has forever, says Steve. God, no, sorry, says Amy, putting her hand on Steve's arm. Let's both spend more time with your son. Why don't you get some sleep, Steve suggests. I'm going to do a bit more thinking about Jeff. This case goes off in very different directions, depending on whether he's alive or dead. Amy shuts her laptop. She looks over at her father-in-law. Thank you, Steve. Always a pleasure, says Steve. What for? For asking if I was scared, says Amy. No one ever asks, but sometimes I am. I don't want to die. Steve gives his daughter-in-law a hug. This beautiful, brave woman scared of dying, and this silly, cowardly man afraid of living. As Amy closes her eyes, Steve opens his file again. Has he discovered the identity of Joe Blow? He'll soon find out. Chapter 58. I am very happy with this poached egg, says Henk van Veen. Very happy indeed. I'm pleased to hear it, says the young man, Ashley, who has just served him.
Poached eggs are hard to get exactly right, says Henk. Firstly, you have selected the correct egg. Free range is an absolute must. I weep to think about battery chickens, do you?
I do, says Ashley.
They are unhappy, says Henk. They are unfulfilled, and no amount of salt can hide it. I will not put salt on a poached egg unless it is absolutely necessary. Today, I am glad to note, it is not necessary.
Terrific, says Ashley.
Secondly, the colour, says Henk. I'm sorry, am I keeping you, Ashley?
Not at all, says Ashley. I am enjoying talking about eggs with you, Mr. Van Veen.
So, the colour, Henk continues. The British often favour a yolk that is altogether too yellow. A good yolk should be orange, in my view. In fact, not just in my view, but in the correct, natural order of things.
Yes, agrees Ashley.
It can also be too orange, of course, says Henk. The perfect colour is somewhere between the beauty of an English sunrise and the colour of the Dutch national football kit. Again, today's egg is perfect.
Can I get you more coffee, perhaps? Asks Ashley.
Henk holds up a finger to Ashley, indicating that they will get on to coffee, but for now, he has more to say about eggs. Consistency. Once the white, firm but yielding, is breached, the yolk must be unstoppable but also determined to take its time. Say the yolk of an egg, Ashley, is the lava from a volcano, and the toast is Pompeii. For me, Pompeii must eventually be destroyed, but the townsfolk should have time to vacate with their belongings before they perish. They can't dawdle too long, but if everybody operates in good order, then there should be no casualties.
We went to Pompeii on a school trip, says Ashley.
The toast is also paramount, says Henk. I mean, of course it is. The English have started insisting on sourdough, and this will not do for me. Quite why it will do for anyone is beyond the limits of my powers. Spinoza once said, I have made a ceaseless effort not to bewail human actions, but to understand them. I say this, Ashley. Spinoza, faultless in so many other ways, had clearly not come across sourdough toast. Seeded granary, lightly toasted and still warm, is the trick, and today that trick has been pulled off with aplomb. And thank you, I will now have a coffee.
Certainly, says Ashley. How do you take it?
Oh, just as it comes, says Henk. I'm not fussy. Ashley leaves to get Henk his coffee. Henk is aware that what makes today's egg perfection all the more extraordinary is that this feat has been managed aboard a plane. Napkin tucked into his shirt, final piece of toast, mopping up final smear of yolk. He will have to pay his compliments to the chef. Amy Wheeler's phone is no longer active, which is to be expected from a professional, so Henk has had to take matters into his own hands. She had been in South Carolina, that he knew for certain. Mail Online has a photograph of Rosie D'Antonio at the airport in St. Lucia, so that must have been their next port of call. It stands to reason, doesn't it, that they are following the path of the murders. Andrew Fairbanks in South Carolina, Bella Sanchez in St. Lucia, so next stop will be Mark Gooch, a few miles outside Cork in Ireland. So that is exactly where Henk is headed. All things being equal, Henk might even arrive there before them. Could be there to greet Amy and her merry band. That would be the ideal for him. Henk dabs at his mouth with the napkin, rises and stretches. He walks towards the galley to thank the chef, and perhaps discuss technique. Maybe even get a card? Henk's personal chef is very good, but what if he were to die? Or find another job? You must always have contingencies, and anyone who can cook the perfect poached egg at 25,000 feet is going to be of interest. The steward, Ashley, perfectly good at his job, gives him a pleasant smile.
Mr. Van Veen, we've already begun our descent into Cork. It might be more comfortable for you to take your seat and fasten your belt.
Henk shakes his head. I like to stand in the aisle when the plane is landing. It is a thrill for me. A small thrill, but a thrill all the same. You must take thrills where you can get them, Ashley.
I certainly try, says Ashley, but I am legally obliged to ask you to return to your seat.
I know you are, says Hank. That's one of the reasons it's a thrill.
To surf the landing. You will join me, perhaps.
There is such a minuscule risk of death.
Ashley takes a look over his shoulder towards the cockpit.
Okay, he says.
Hank smiles. Today will be a good day. The perfect egg, a spot of plane surfing, a gun wrapped in so much sawdust it will clear all cursory airport checks, and, above all, a minuscule risk of death.
For him, at least.
Chapter 59. The arrivals hall at Dublin Airport is quiet.
You take a taxi into town, says Amy. I have to see a man about a gun.
She doesn't have to see a man about a gun. She's actually picking one up from a quiet suburban house to the west of Dublin on Tuesday morning. But her business at the airport is not finished, and she doesn't want to worry Steve and Rosie. Amy senses danger, and she learnt long ago to trust her senses. It is around 12 a.m. on Monday, though with time differences, it could be the middle of the day. That sort of thing never really worries Amy. Rosie has booked them all into a hotel in the middle of Dublin, and on Tuesday she has arranged for a helicopter to fly them to the vineyard near Cork. Apparently the private hangar at Cork was full on Monday.
A night out for you and me later then, Stevie, says Rosie.
I have a few contacts in Dublin.
Not for me, says Steve. I'm going to stay in my room.
No, you're not, says Rosie.
You've never been to Dublin before, says Amy. Why not see a bit of it before we head to Cork tomorrow?
I'm sure Dublin is lovely, says Steve, but I have a few films to watch.
You're coming drinking tonight, says Rosie, if I have to drag you by the hair.
I haven't watched any TV for days, says Steve. Surely no one would begrudge me. Rosie rolls her eyes.
He's been through a lot, says Amy. Perhaps we let him win this one. Amy sees them both into a taxi. Hopefully, by the next time she sees them, everything will be settled. She looks at her watch, then at the multi-story car park opposite the cab rank.
You're coming out drinking when you're finished, though, says Rosie out of the cab window.
You have my guarantee, says Amy. Night-night, Steve. Love you. The taxi drives off. Amy will definitely join Rosie for that drink, if she survives the next 30 minutes. Chapter 60. When was the last time Tony Taylor had a date?
Hard to remember. 1987? Something like that.
The Thatcher era, certainly. But despite his rustiness, it had gone well. Felicity talked about television, famous actors, presenters you'd have heard of. Tony talked about the parking problems in Axley and the Ford Sierra Cosworth he's currently fine-tuning. They both asked questions, they both drank wine, and neither could keep the silly grins from their faces. He had taken Felicity to a restaurant called The Pig in Brockenhurst, not far from Axley. It was wonderful, as it should be at those prices. It is very important to show a bit of class on the first date. Tony certainly remembers that much. But he hopes that Felicity doesn't come to expect this sort of thing regularly. He is a modest man of modest means. They took a walk around the gardens after dinner, and they kissed under a sycamore tree. Felicity is going to stay in Steve's empty house this evening. Steve has okayed it. Tomorrow morning, Tony is taking her on a tour of the New Forest. Lymington, Bewley, the Forest Walk at Boulder, the old shipyard at Buckler's Hard, all the sights. Get some fudge, maybe. Tony was very glad when she agreed to a nightcap back in Axley at the Brass Monkey. Much more his speed. Tony has just nipped back from the gents and stops for a moment to watch Felicity in animated conversation with John and Jyoti. He wonders what they're talking about. Hopefully not him. John and Jyoti are both liabilities in that regard. He wishes Steve was here too. But Amy needs him, and a man's got to do what a man's got to do. If you can say that sort of thing these days. Steve says the fellow who came to his garage the other day was murdered down at Holland's Wood. Not something Tony has mentioned to Felicity, because not everyone liked talking about murder, did they? Especially on a first date. He walks over to the table they are sharing and takes his seat next to his pint.
"Blood everywhere," says John.
"Shot him, then dragged his body away," Jyoti adds.
"Did Steve see the body?" Felicity asks.
"We don't need to hear about all this," says Tony.
Felicity smiles at Tony.
"I can't believe you talked about a Ford Sierra instead of this."
"It's a Sierra Cosworth," says John, to be fair to Tony.
"I just didn't want you to think that the New Forest is all murders," says Tony. "There are ponies, all sorts."
"I can handle ponies and murders," says Felicity.
"She's a keeper," says Jyoti.
"Tell us more about this woman in prison, Tony," says John.
"Tell you about what?"
says Felicity, sipping her pint.
"Your client," says Jyoti, "in prison in Dubai."
"I don't think I've got any clients in prison in Dubai," says Felicity, "unless Alan Baxter has started drinking again."
"Tony told us about her," says John, "at the lock-in the other night. We were all talking about Steve's murders."
"Yeah, I don't think I did," says Tony. "I wasn't even at the lock-in."
"Then who told us?" says Jyoti.
John shrugs and downs his pint.
"Well, someone did.
Who's for another round?" Jyoti raises her empty glass in assent. Tony sneaks a look at Felicity. He motions towards the door with his eyes, and she gives a small nod.
First the kiss under the sycamore tree, and now the small nod. What a night.
"I'm going to walk Felicity home," says Tony.
"I'll bet you are," says John, then extends his hand. "Felicity, a great pleasure. You got a good one here."
"Thank you," says Felicity, "and thank you for the graphic descriptions of the murder."
"Not at all," says John. "You wouldn't get that at the Flagon."
Jyoti stands too and embraces Felicity.
"I hope we see a lot more of you in Axley."
"I hope so too," says Felicity.
As Felicity turns, letting Tony help her into her jacket, Jyoti puts her hand on her heart and nods at Tony.
Tony smiles in return. When was the last good thing that happened to him? He follows Felicity out into the summer evening air, and they link arms and walk up the hill towards Steve's house. Tony carries her overnight bag.
"It's very beautiful here," says Felicity.
"I might come back again, you know."
"I think my friends liked you," says Tony.
"I liked them too," says Felicity.
"What was that about Dubai?"
"Honestly," says Tony, "they drink a fair bit, those two. A couple of weeks ago, John said he saw Camilla Parker Bowles in the Brockenhurst Co-op."
Felicity smiles. "This is us," says Tony, as they reach Steve's cottage.
"Oh, it's lovely," says Felicity, "and so much more private than the sycamore tree. Will you join me for a coffee, Tony?"
"I don't really drink coffee," Tony starts, before catching Felicity's look.
"Of course, I'll get you settled in, show you where the fuse box is."
As he puts Steve's spare key in the lock, Tony could swear he sees a flash of light from an upstairs window, as if a curtain had been drawn back and quickly replaced.
"Is someone in the house?"
"Impossible."
But he opens the door with care, just in case. As Felicity slips off her jacket, Tony jumps at a sudden noise, then sees a familiar black cat pad down the stairs with something to say for himself.
Of course there was no one in the house.
It was just trouble.
Chapter 61. Amy needs to stay awake just a while longer. Fortunately, she has thinking to do. Thinking about Henk van Veen, thinking about Jeff, thinking about Joe Blow and Francois Loubet. What has she got herself caught up in here? She thinks about being killed, thinks about Steve being killed, thinks about Adam being on the other side of the world. When did she become so sentimental? It's ridiculous. One thing she can control is being good at her job, trusting her instincts and taking pains. Whoever is trying to kill her is no fool.
They've got away with killing 4 people already, with almost no leads left behind. They hired Kevin to kill her, and he wasn't bad. He wasn't good enough, but not many are. You can prepare for pretty much anything in this game, but nobody expects to be bludgeoned by a shoulder-padded novelist with a cinematography Oscar. That was bad luck. It follows, therefore, that Eddie Flood is no fool either. Whether Henk hired him, or Lou Bay hired him, or Henk is Lou Bay, Eddie will be a professional. A professional who just fell for a sucker's trick and flew to Hawaii. Will they really catch Eddie out with the same trick twice? Amy doubts it. It's lovely to believe that Eddie is, even now, enjoying a gin and tonic on his way to Fiji, but Amy is placing a different bet. Amy is placing a bet that Eddie is on the plane with the call sign F716A, which left St. Lucia just 3 hours after her own. And that's why she has broken into this very comfortable Mercedes in the long-stay car park of Dublin Airport, with a perfect view of the taxi queue. Below her is a floral display spelling out, "Welcome to Dublin." She plans to give Eddie a welcome of her own. Follow him, question him, and if it comes to it, kill him. If that happens tonight, it will have to be with her bare hands. It is very possible, though, that Eddie won't even know who has hired him. Kevin hadn't seemed to. If Eddie is on that plane, no doubt he'll rest up in Dublin for the day, before heading to Cork in the morning. The row of taxis is getting very little business at this time of night, the drivers all standing around a single car and discussing the events of their days. Flight F716A touched down about 15 minutes ago. Amy gives Eddie 25 minutes or so to taxi towards the terminal and to clear customs. Amy has tried to find who chartered flight F716A, with very little luck. The world of private jets can be opaque at times. The airport is quietening down, and the electronic doors on the front of the terminal are shut more than they're open. Every time they burp someone out, Amy is on full alert. It's all very well thinking about Henk and about François Loubet, but Amy can't stop a niggling little voice from saying Jeff Nolan's name too. Jeff knew where all 3 victims would be. Jeff knew they were all unprotected, and to cap it all, Jeff must have signed off on Kevin working with her and Rosie. Could Jeff be a killer? Yes. Would Jeff try to kill her? Again, all you can do is to trust your instincts. And her instincts say no. Her instincts certainly say that Jeff is not dead. But perhaps that is her being sentimental again. It's a curse. Amy's phone buzzes. A message from Rosie at the hotel. It's a photograph. They're in a residence bar, Rosie looking mischievous, raising a glass of Guinness to the camera, her arm round Steve, who is doing the same. It's not a long drive from the airport to the hotel, 10 minutes or so, but Rosie had clearly worked her magic in that time. Steve looks happy. Rosie always looks happy. The sliding doors open once again, and 3 students with rucksacks emerge. Eddie is taking his sweet time. What if customs have stopped him? He wouldn't be stupid enough to carry a gun, surely. There are ways of smuggling. A sudden noise, and the back windscreen of the Mercedes shatters. Amy throws herself to the ground. Someone is firing from directly behind the car, firing and getting closer. She risks a look into the rearview mirror. It's Eddie Flood. He's not just good. He's very good. But she's still alive. Eddie has a gun, and Amy has nothing. She has a car, sure, but no way of starting it. Amy lies flat across the front 2 seats. If Eddie wants to check she's alive, he's not going to be able to do it from any of the back windows. He'll have to go to the driver's side door. Right on cue, Eddie appears at the window and levels his gun. Amy hooks 1 foot under the door release, and then kicks out with the other leg, sending the door swinging open and Eddie flying across the concrete. Amy springs up, opens the passenger side door, and, as Eddie regains his balance, she dives over the parapet of the car park, landing on the "Welcome to Dublin" floral display. Eddie fires one more shot from above before, sensibly in Amy's view, realising this is all too public. The few onlookers were already screaming and pointing. The taxi drivers suddenly have something new to talk about. Amy runs across the airport access road and jumps into the first taxi on the rank. Temple Bar Hotel, she says to the driver while keeping her head out of sight.
That's a nice hotel, right enough, says the driver. That's you being shot at, is it?
Afraid so, says Amy.
Welcome to Dublin, says the taxi driver,
putting her foot hard to the floor and screeching away. As they take a bend at speed, one final shot smashes the back window. The driver looks at where her window used to be and at Amy brushing glass from her jacket. I'll not ask if it's business or pleasure.
Chapter 62.
It's such an honour, says Mark, the makeup artist, but it's very hard to make you look any more fabulous.
Thank you, says Rosie.
And I've had almost no sleep.
You are so drama, says Mark. So drama. I love it.
Whenever drama is in short supply, you must
create your own, says Rosie.
When I'm not writing stories, I try to live them.
Oh, you are extra, says Mark. You are extra, extra. You know what I mean? Rosie does know what he means. She is drama and she is extra. She has always been able to create chaos out of nothing, to spin the people around her like plates. Rosie can turn a calm sea into a maelstrom with a single word here or a single glance there. It can be tiring, but it keeps reality from the door.
You're like Lizzo, says Mark. We've had her on. She brought her own makeup people, though.
Chaos is a jungle in which it's easy to hide, and Rosie has, therefore, enjoyed the last day or so very much. And she is aware there is more fun to come.
Rosie had taken Steve for a drink straight away. Steve had objected at first, but Rosie had once persuaded a Buddhist monk to do LSD in an infinity pool, so Steve was no match for her.
Just one pint, he had said.
Several hours later, they were still in the residence bar when Amy had appeared, with a slight limp and a story to tell. The floor manager pokes her head around the door of the makeup room.
On air in 5.
She hardly needs a thing, says Mark. I told her, you're like Lizzo.
Amy had told them that Eddie was in Dublin after all, the sly old fox, armed to the teeth and determined to finish the job that Kevin had started. Amy didn't give them the whole story, however much Rosie pleaded, but she had broken glass and magnolia petals in her pocket, so something interesting had gone on. Rosie ordered more drinks for them all.
What's the big announcement then?
Mark asks, adding some final hairspray.
Secret, I'm afraid, says Rosie.
What's said in the makeup room stays in the makeup room, says Mark.
It's like Vegas.
But what to do about Eddie? He was in Ireland, he was armed, and he would surely be following them to Cork. So Amy is currently buying a gun for €4,000, while Rosie waits to go on Ireland's leading breakfast television show. You have to play to your own strengths. One drink turned into another and then, as so often in life, into another, at which point Rosie's current plan to foil Eddie Flood came into focus. At 6 p.m, as the bar began to fill with revellers just beginning their evening, Rosie sent a message to a man called Michael O'Doherty, the producer of An Irish Breakfast, promising a scoop, and they all promptly went to bed.
Michael, whose main guest of that morning was due to be a pet psychic, jumped at the chance, and at 6:45 a.m, a car came to the bar to take Rosie to the studios of RTE.
They stopped en route at a newsagent with a photocopier, stopped once again for Steve to be sick, dropped Amy off on a nondescript suburban street corner with her pockets filled with cash, and arrived at the studio with time to spare. Steve is currently lying down in a darkened dressing room. Some people just can't handle 12 pints of Guinness. She and Amy were fresh as daisies. On the TV, high on the wall of the makeup room, Rosie hears one of the hosts, Kelly, say,
"And coming up, one of our favourite guests is back. Rosie D'Antonio will be joining us on the sofa with a big announcement, and she needs your help."
Her co-host, Ryan, casually handsome, like so many Irish men, moves on. More on the shots fired at Dublin Airport. Early Monday morning, there are no confirmed casualties. Niall Clark has this report. The floor manager reappears. Okay, that's us. After this VT, can I get you into the studio? Rosie takes one last look at the screen, where a group of animated taxi drivers are being interviewed. She is led through a heavy metal door into the airlock space they always have in TV studios to let you know that you are leaving the world of reality and entering the world of television. The floor manager opens a second metal door, and Rosie finds herself in the Irish Breakfast studio. Niall Clark is finishing his report as the two hosts ignore the VT, heads down in their scripts. On the screen, a female taxi driver is saying, "I never saw anything." Though Rosie notes that she has plastic sheeting taped across the space where her rear passenger window should be. Kelly and Ryan look up as Rosie is seated next to them. They look thrilled to see her, as well they might, knowing they've been saved an interview with a man staring into the eyes of a dog and saying, "I feel like he's lost someone recently." They whisper their happy hellos as the countdown for the end of the VT begins in the studio. Rosie checks herself in the studio monitor. Say what you like about her, she can hold her drink. "Niall Clark reporting there," says Kelly. "Quite the mystery at Dublin Airport."
"And speaking of mystery," says Ryan, "she sold over 50 million books." "Over 60 million, says Rosie. "Over 60 million books, says Ryan. "Apologies. She's got through five husbands, am I right there?" "The third one wasn't strictly legal," says Rosie. "So four and a half. But still looking for more, Ryan." "And we always love having her on an Irish breakfast. It's Rosie D'Antonio. Welcome to Ireland, Rosie." "Thank you, Ryan," says Rosie. "You smell amazing, by the way." Ryan gives a bashful gesture of dismissal.
"Now," says Kelly, "how are you enjoying Ireland?"
"Well," says Rosie, "I had 12 pints of Guinness yesterday." "A woman after our own hearts," says Ryan. "And have you murder on your mind while you're here?" "Honestly, yes, I do," says Rosie.
"But you have an announcement to make, I think," says Kelly. "You're looking for some help."
"I am," says Rosie, "and thank you for letting me use your viewers." "What, both of them?" says Ryan, with the laugh of a man who knows he has Ireland's biggest breakfast show. Rosie laughs too, because he really is very handsome.
"I was recently swimming on a lake in South Carolina, you see," starts Rosie, always at ease with stories. "A lovely warm day. I was wearing virtually nothing. Can you imagine, Ryan?" Ryan pretends to fan himself. "And I got into trouble," says Rosie. Kelly leans forward in concern. Ryan nods, sternly in concern. "There was a strong current," says Rosie, "and I'm not as young as I once was." According to Wikipedia, she is actually 5 years younger than she was 7 years ago. Rosie likes to think of herself as age fluid.
"Now, I've killed a lot of people over the years," says Rosie, "in my books. But I began to think, this is it for me, you know?"
"How terrifying," says Kelly.
"But then, as I started to go under, I felt two strong arms pull me up."
"Oh, it's like something from a book," says Kelly, "like something you'd read."
"A man swam me to shallower waters," says Rosie, "and I thanked him for saving my life, and he just said, 'No problem, no problem.' I asked him what I could do for him. Could I reward him? Did he live nearby? Could I send him something?" "I mean, you've sold over 60 million books," says Ryan.
"But he asked for nothing," says Rosie. "He just said, 'I'm here as a tourist.' He got out of the lake, took a round of applause, and disappeared." "A hero," says Kelly, "an absolute hero. God bless his soul."
"I see," says Ryan.
"Now where do we come in?"
"Well," says Rosie,
"I told you he said, 'No problem, no problem.' But what I didn't tell you was that he said it in an Irish accent." Kelly gasps. She is a great audience. "I'd say specifically a Cork accent," says Rosie. And so I'm here to find him and to thank him for saving my life.
Wonderful, says Ryan.
Can you describe him?
I can do better than that, says Rosie. One of the onlookers took his photo, and I have it.
Kelly is being told something in her ear.
I think we can see it now.
On the screens in the studio, and on the screens of a million breakfasting Irish folk, appears the face of Eddie Flood. Steve had found it on a Facebook group for fans of Lambrettas.
If you recognise him, says Rosie, if you see him anywhere, particularly if you're in Cork, somewhere around there, there's an email address where you can contact my people. If you can tell me exactly where he is, there's a reward of 20,000 euros.
20,000 euros if our viewers can spot him.
Eddie's face fills the screen again. An email address appears underneath. Amy set it up last night.
You have to email the moment you see him and tell me exactly where he is. Maybe have your photo taken with him. I so want to thank him.
Hug him for me too. All of you.
What a wonderful story, says Ryan. And what a wonderful opportunity for the people of Cork. 20,000 euros up for grabs if you can tell Rosie where this hero is.
That goes for the police too, says Rosie.
Whoever spots him gets the money.
I want everyone in Ireland keeping an eye out for this man and telling me exactly where he is.
Thank you, Rosie D'Antonio, says Ryan.
And hurry back.
Now, a mystery in a sleepy Cork village. A local police officer tells pals he's won the lottery and is found dead just days later.
With the... Rosie is led offset. Steve has made his way out of the darkened dressing room and onto the studio floor.
Did I do good? Rosie asks. I'm afraid I had my head in a bucket, says Steve.
Rosie slaps him on the back.
Come on, soldier. We've got a helicopter to catch.
Chapter 63.
Eddie Flood knows the game is up. Time to ring Rob. He's already emailed over the footage of Rosie on an Irish breakfast.
Boss, says Eddie as Rob picks up.
Never seen anything like it, says Rob.
How's your morning been?
Busy,
says Eddie. He hadn't had a clue what was going on. He was mobbed in the foyer, chased into his cab, followed to the airfield by three kids on motorbikes, photographed by his cabbie, by the airfield porter, by the helicopter pilot, and met by a crowd of around 40 to 50 people at the small landing field outside Cork, all of whom had been alerted to his movements and keen to make a bit of money.
Popular show.
How did she know you were there?
Took a shot at Amy Wheeler yesterday morning, says Eddie, and didn't hear.
Christ, Eddie, says Rob. You're supposed to be good at this.
You used to be.
Yeah,
sighs Eddie. She was in a Mercedes, tinted back window, so I didn't get a clear shot. And I didn't think she was going to jump out of a multi-story car park.
You're off the job, says Rob. You understand?
Of course, says Eddie. Let you down, let myself down.
And your photo is everywhere, says Rob.
Yeah, agrees Eddie. Not good, not good, understood.
Keep the 15 grand, Eddie, says Rob. But that's the best I can do. And it's only because you're a mate.
Thanks, boss, says Eddie.
He was going to keep the 15 grand anyway, whatever Rob had said. He has something he needs to spend it on.
Now I've got to find somebody else to kill her, says Rob.
Eddie is barely listening. He's thinking ahead. This latest development might actually be useful to him. When a Navy SEAL and an East Ham hard man have already failed.
Feel for you, says Eddie.
Why not try a Scandinavian? They don't muck about.
If she doesn't die, I'm dead, says Rob.
Gotta go, it's my putt.
Eddie clicks his phone off and wonders again who Rob is working for. It would be very useful to work it out, for obvious reasons, to be the one to fit that jigsaw together. That's information he could use to his advantage. But he's got his own ghost to worry about. What to do right now is the big question. Rob is off his case. That's good.
He's got 15 grand to help him along. That's good too.
How long does he need? Another week, maybe?
And until then, though, he needs to keep close to Amy Wheeler because her next move will be his next move. The back windscreen of the Mercedes hadn't been tinted. Eddie had had a clear headshot. He could have killed Amy Wheeler in a heartbeat. He'd had a clear shot at the taxi, too. He shot and missed for two very good reasons. Firstly, he needs Amy Wheeler to stay alive, and secondly, he needs to be noticed. Staring at his own picture on the Sky News app on his laptop, captioned with, "Who is this mystery hero?" Eddie would say it was mission accomplished. He won't be able to get anywhere near them for now, but that's okay. Gives him time to finish everything. Make it perfect.
Chapter 64.
Henk has never drunk Irish wine before, but he is a firm believer in fitting in. Fitting in is the very best way to hide. Left to his own devices, Henk would drink only milk, but for reasons he cannot begin to understand, that seems to unnerve people. With a little time to kill, he has tagged along with a tour group, currently being guided around Rockgrove Vineyard. It is terrifically interesting. As they walk between low rows of green vines, Henk spies the tree where Mark Gooch was found dead. He points at it and addresses the group.
"Ah, the tree where Mark Gooch was found dead."
This is met with the muted horror he has come to expect from other people. Civilians.
"You know,"
says Henk, "the influencer. They nailed him to it.
Perhaps the holes are still there?"
Henk recognises that sometimes he is simply too Dutch, but he never sees the need to leave a truth unsaid. The tour guide is hurriedly changing the subject. "And the Backerscrape, originally imported from Germany, is fast becoming a staple of Irish wine production." The rest of the group are now keeping a discreet distance from Henk. They'd be keeping even more of a distance if they'd known he had a gun tucked into his waistband. Henk checks the updates on his phone. Amy Wheeler should be here in the next half hour or so. What will they do once they arrive? He supposes they will talk to the people he has already spoken to. The manager. The staff who were working there on the day Mark Gooch died. What will they discover? They will discover that Mark Gooch arrived in a taxi driven by a woman with long, red hair. They will discover that he was carrying a large leather holdall that was later nowhere to be seen. And they will discover that he was found by a local off-duty police officer who happened to be wandering around the vineyard as dusk turned to night. They will discover what they already know. But then, when they sit down to lunch, they will discover something else. They will discover Henk Van Veen with a gun, and with a piece of information that will unlock their puzzle once and for all. That Jeff Nolan is behind everything. It is very good, thinks Henk, to be in the fresh air, with justice on one's mind. He wanders over to the tree. The holes have been filled in with wood glue, then painted over. You would have to look very closely to know that anything had happened at all. Henk thinks this is most interesting, so shouts over to the rest of the tour party.
"They have filled all the holes with wood glue. Really tremendous job."
Chapter 65. Steve had suggested that they should leave him behind in Dublin, but here he is, banking steeply in a small helicopter, buffeted by winds and with a keg of Guinness refusing to leave his belly. The pilot had told him,
"If you're going to be sick, make sure we're over fields."
And he has been vomit-bombing the beautiful green patchwork of Ireland with regularity since they took to the air. Amy's phone rings. She looks at the name on the screen and answers. She speaks over the noise of the rotors.
"Adam. Yes, yes, I know. I'm in a helicopter. No, a helicopter. Ireland. Ireland, the country. Bono. The cause. The cause. Yes, he's with me. He's throwing up. Guinness. Guinness. Well, now he does drink it. What did you get from Courtney?
Yep. Yep.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You sure? What are you having for dinner? For dinner? Yeah. Yep. Not much. Someone tried to shoot me. Shoot me. Shoot me. Yeah, yeah, he missed. He missed. Should we talk when I'm not in a helicopter? I miss you. Miss you. No, I miss you, Adam. Doesn't matter. Talk later.
That's literally the most romantic I've ever heard you, shouts Rosie.
Whenever I get shot at, I miss him, Amy shouts back. Steve, you must be out of vomit by now. Steve nods and tries to sit up straight.
This poor country.
So, Adam saw Courtney Lewis? He went to see her, shouts Amy, but he didn't see her.
He shouldn't have taken no for an answer, says Rosie.
He didn't, says Amy.
She's dead.
She's what? Steve asks. Amy shouts into his ear. She's dead. They found her in her cell the day before. The pilot turns to them.
Beginning descent. No more vomiting.
Steve gives him a weak thumbs up. How did she die? Rosie asks. They wouldn't tell him, says Amy.
Did they know Adam was going to see her? Asks Steve.
Of course, says Amy. Believe it or not, you have to make an appointment to visit someone in a Dubai prison.
So, says Steve, we find out about Courtney Lewis from Felicity Wollaston, and the next moment she's dead.
The vineyard is rising up to meet them, green on green, an impossible beauty.
You need to ring Tony Taylor, says Amy. Get more details. We need to know exactly what Felicity Wollaston knows.
And who she's told, says Rosie. The helicopter reaches solid ground. Steve closes his eyes in silent thanks.
Have you enjoyed your first helicopter trip? The pilot asks him.
Please apologise to the Irish countryside for me. Are people sick all the time in helicopters?
Happens a lot, says the pilot.
But you're my new record holder. Steve looks over at Rosie. You're not hungover, not queasy. Rosie shakes her head.
I've kept myself topped up since 1978.
They exit the helicopter, Steve ducking below the slowing blades, Amy and Rosie walking tall, confident of the 5-foot gap between their heads and the rotors.
Ring Tony, Amy tells Steve.
Steve does as he is told, and Tony Taylor answers on the third ring.
Stephen Wheeler, says Tony, late of this parish. How might I help you?
You sound chipper, says Steve.
Walking through the forest with Felicity, says Tony.
We've got bad news for her, says Steve. Her client, Courtney Lewis. She's dead.
1 second, says Tony. Tony puts his finger over the microphone, so Steve only hears a muffled chat. Tony and Felicity, eh? Seems to be going well. The line clears again.
She's never heard of her, says Tony.
Courtney Lewis?
Never heard of her, says Tony.
But you told us about her, says Steve. So how did you hear about her?
It's literally impossible that anyone else in Axley would know the connection.
You're the detective, mate, says Tony.
Felicity says hi, by the way. She was eating an ice cream and she got some on her nose. Honestly, it's the cutest thing you've ever seen.
Steve hears Felicity giggle. Actually giggle. My God, love is a wonderful but also sickening thing.
Listen, says Steve, say hi back from me and enjoy yourself.
Aye, aye, Captain, says Tony. Over and out.
Steve hears Felicity giggle again. Bit much now. He puts his phone back in his pocket. Amy and Rosie are waiting for his news.
The information didn't come from Tony. He swears to it. And Felicity says she's never heard of Courtney Lewis.
So?
Rosie's question hangs in the air.
So listen, says Steve. Perhaps someone else in Axley just happened to have that information. Just happened to be in the pub and mention it. Or, says Amy, knowing Steve well enough to not finish the sentence, or Felicity Wollaston is lying to Tony.
And lying to us, says Amy. Is Felicity Wollaston lying to them? How much does Tony really know about her?
Well, while you work your way through that, let's interview someone about a man nailed to a tree, says Rosie, walking towards the winery. She looks back at them, over her shoulder. And I wouldn't say no to a drink.
Chapter 66.
Max Highfield is so furious, he can barely enjoy the Emirates first-class lounge. Where is his bodyguard? They had a deal. Max takes his business to Henk. Henk hires the best bodyguard he has for him. So why is he sitting here alone? Why did he just have to get his own salad? Why is the bodyguard meeting him in Dubai and not here? A nervous-looking teenager approaches him.
Are you Max Highfield?
Well, 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 here we go. This is what happens. Are you Max Highfield? Take a wild guess, kid. Who else looks like this? Who else is wearing a custom-made Gucci knitted tank top in first class? Max raises his sunglasses to confirm that it is indeed him, and then motions to his salad to let the teenager know it is rude to approach someone when they're eating. Good to learn that lesson, young.
Titans of War is my favourite film, says the teenager,
not picking up on Max's salad cue.
It's so good.
They underuse me in that, says Max.
Could this kid have picked a more annoying film? Why doesn't anyone mention The Rose of Sarasota?
I was like, I don't just do action, you know?
The teenager nods uncertainly. Yeah, I liked it when you kicked that man off that spaceship.
How does a teenager get into the Emirates First Class Lounge anyway?
If Max was actually paying for his ticket, he'd be even more angry. The Diamond Conference people are paying. Max is hosting, and two writers called Sean and Christine have written a few jokes for him. It's the only ceremony with more carrots than the British Vegetarian Awards. That one is a pun about carrots, as in diamonds, sounding the same as carrots, as in vegetables. They had explained it and guaranteed it would work. The teenager is still staring at him. Max puts his sunglasses back on and starts to eat his salad.
Could I get a photograph? Asks the teenager.
This is why Max will never forgive Henk. He's on his own here. Henk should have someone with him 24/7, except when Max doesn't want someone with him. But here he is, defenceless.
Sure, says Max.
The youngster takes out his phone. He's trembling, which is something, at least, a mark of respect. The boy gives a shy smile, and Max gives a tough guy scowl. He is lucky in that people prefer it when he scowls. He knows some actors who have to smile when they meet members of the public, and it kills them.
Thank you, says the kid.
He's not a bad kid, but this is not something Max should be dealing with alone. Max nods to him and goes back to his kale. The kid runs back excitedly to his parents. The dad gives Max a thumbs up. Another invasion of privacy. Can't a man just kick back in his lime green tank top and get a bit of peace? Max rings Henk. One of the lounge staff approaches. Sorry, sir, no calls in the lounge.
I know, says Max. But I'm Max Highfield.
The woman has no answer to this. Henk isn't answering. You wouldn't get this from Jeff Nolan. Jeff would see his name and pick up. Middle of the night, whenever. Perhaps it's not going to work out with Henk after all, but Max has burned all his bridges by now. Max will see how the Dubai bodyguard goes. He's taking a keener interest these days. Previously, Max had had bodyguards only because everyone else had them, and he didn't want to feel less important than, say, Ben Affleck. But now, since the messages have started, the death threats, he feels he might actually need one. The last one read, "I know what you did, and you won't get away with it. R.I.P. What has he got himself mixed up in? Not that he would admit this to Henk or to Jeff or to his therapist, but somebody has his number, in more ways than one. In The Rose of Sarasota, Max plays a soldier back from Vietnam or possibly Korea, but Max can't see what an American soldier would have been doing in Korea, so probably Vietnam. He has an illness. In the script it was cancer, but Max didn't think that was glamorous enough, so in the end they left it vague. He remembers the key was it had to be an illness that wouldn't cause him to lose weight, because he was filming Hercules versus Poseidon straight afterwards. So he had this illness, and he was in a hospice, coughing, etc., telling old women he loved them, and he really thought, this is it, this is the Oscar. But no. The movie industry buried it. Politics again. And it wasn't even on Netflix last time Max looked, which was yesterday. He will check again this evening. The only country where it did good numbers was China. And that, Max later discovered, was because they edited in lots of clips of Max from a Second World War film he'd shot and pretended they were flashbacks. You do have to take the rough with the smooth, but Max had been very angry that The Rose of Sarasota hadn't been a hit. Very angry, and just sometimes, when he woke in the middle of the night, very sad too. Max doesn't think about death all that much. Death to him is dummy guns and blood spatter packs and stuntmen falling onto crash mats. But he thought about death when he was filming The Rose of Sarasota. And in the brutal, lonely luxury of the Emirates first class lounge, he is thinking about death once again. Chapter 67.
I had to come and see you, says Hank, because you wouldn't return my calls.
Hank had been waiting for them in the private dining room of the Rock Grove Vineyard. Amy should have known. They had just shaken Eddie off their tail, and now this.
I wish to inform you that I have a gun, says Hank.
You're not going to shoot me here, Hank, says Amy, so stop showing off.
Why would you want to kill Amy?
Asks Rosie, sitting down.
I'm Rosie D'Antonio.
It is my great pleasure, Ms. D'Antonio, says Hank. I know many people enjoy your books, and surely they can't all be wrong.
I might put that on my next front cover, says Rosie.
Steve Wheeler, says Steve, shaking Hank's hand, father-in-law.
Ah, the mystery man, says Hank. I hope I haven't frightened you, Mr. Wheeler.
You look pale?
Steve waves this away and sits down.
You're here to kill me, Hank, says Amy.
Goodness, no, says Hank, laughing at the very thought.
Amy isn't laughing.
Then why do you have a gun?
To protect myself from you and to deliver you to the relevant authorities, says Hank. I thought that would be obvious.
You think Amy has something to do with the murders? Steve asks. Hank nods.
Mm-hmm. I trust you visited the tree as I did.
Steve looks out of the window towards the tree. They've done a lovely job with that wood glue.
Is that the first time you've seen that tree, Amy? Hank asks.
Amy looks at him and nods.
Haven't nailed anyone to it? Asks Hank.
In recent memory?
No, says Amy. Same question to you.
No, dear me, no, says Hank. Why would you think I was involved? You must know quite the opposite to be true.
Amy thinks about Jeff's warning. Don't trust Hank. I know you split with Jeff, and then Jeff's client started dying.
And we know you've been very keen to track Amy down, says Steve. Well, of course, says Hank. I'm trying to solve the murders, and Amy is my chief suspect.
I'm your chief suspect.
Well, you're my only suspect, I would say.
Hank smiles.
That's why I have a gun. Jeff was working with Francois Loubet. You all know that, surely. He took him on as a client. Jeff was able to have direct contact with him, and Jeff was able to know the whereabouts of all clients at all times.
Amy shakes her head. Jeff can't be Joe Blow. Come on, the two of you were best friends.
That's why I left Maximum Impact Solutions, says Hank. When our clients started to get arrested, it wasn't difficult to fathom what was happening, and the information Loubet needed for his scheme could only have come from myself or Jeff, and it didn't come from me.
Other people had access to those files, says Steve.
Susan Knox?
Henk shakes his head and pulls an envelope from a briefcase set down by his chair.
You have proof it's Jeff in that little envelope of yours? Rosie asks.
Firstly, it's not a little envelope. It is an A4, says Henk.
Apologies, says Rosie, raising her glass to him.
And secondly, yes, says Henk. I have proof in this normal-sized envelope. The master client files from Maximum Impact. They show that the following five people, Jackson Lynch, Courtney Lewis, Mark Gooch, Bella Sanchez, and Andrew Fairbanks, were all recruited to the company personally by Jeff Nolan.
All of them? Asks Amy.
All of them, confirms Henk. And every single other client who has been on an assignment for Vivid Viral Media, there are 35 in all, was recruited by Jeff.
Oh, that looks bad, says Rosie.
It does look bad, but Steve is thinking about something else. About who else would have known about Courtney Lewis being in that Dubai prison cell.
So Jeff was running an international money smuggling operation with Francois Loubet, says Amy, combatively. That's your big theory?
Yes, says Henk. Jeff was working with Francois Loubet, the world's most successful money smuggler. I will stake my entire reputation on that. And you were his soldier. I don't know why you both had to kill those people. You will have had your reasons. But I believe that you did.
There is silence around the table, broken by Steve.
I'm just thinking about the pub quiz, says Steve. Tomorrow night at the Brass Monkey. The four of us are going.
Rosie laughs.
No one is to kill anyone for the next 24 hours, says Steve. That's all I ask. And Henk? I need to take a look at those files, please.
Don't bother shredding them, says Henk. I have copies.
Time to go home, says Steve.
There's someone I need you all to meet.
Chapter 68.
From the desk of Francois Loubet, ChatGPT, rewrite in the style of a friendly English gentleman, please.
I had a tremendous laugh, I must say, at Rob Kenner's latest tale.
His hitman outwitted by Rosie D'Antonio, the famous writer and also attractive woman. Just because business is serious doesn't mean you can't enjoy it from time to time. That is another lesson for you. We all like a good chuckle, so I suspect Rob was hoping I might be understanding, but I am not. In truth, he has lost my confidence. Enough is enough. I have decided that, though it ill behoves me to so do, I must now also involve the police. I shall ensure they are aware of Amy Wheeler's blood being found at all three scenes. What a careless ninny she has been. If Amy Wheeler doesn't die within the next 48 hours, she will most certainly be arrested. Dead would be best, but one mustn't get too greedy. In better news, I have a shipment leaving London for Sao Paulo in 2 days' time. And I don't need Joe Blow this time. It has been booked directly.